very much looking forward to what Allie has learned about Pema Chodron. Tell us about Pema Chodron, please.
Thank you. Yeah, I guess just out of curiosity, Pema Chodron is somebody that I've been familiar with for several years now, but just out of curiosity, is that a name familiar with the people here? Like, I can't. Okay, yeah, Peter for sure.
Here in the
Julian.
room, John, Christy. So a couple people here.
Couple people. Okay. So I'm very excited to introduce you all, for those of you who are not familiar with Pema Chodron, to who she is and some of her core teachings. And for those of you who are familiar with her, I mean, I'm sure, you know, if you've read her books or listened to her talks, a lot of this will sound familiar, and hopefully I might fill in some blanks. But I feel, you know, very grateful and honored to be able to speak about one of my favorite Buddhist teachers. Pema Chodron was really a gateway for me into Buddhist practices. And while I will describe some of the profound effects she's had on me during this talk, I know that she's truly inspired countless people all over the world, including many of you listening to this talk. So tonight, in addition to sharing some of my own personal accounts of her impacts, I'm also going to be providing an overview of her life experience and, most importantly, a review of her core teachings. So my introduction to Pema began 5 years ago in the aftermath of a breakup while I was, you know, wading the waters of grief and longing, which, you know, as I was thinking about it, often seems like a kind of archetypal motif for spiritual seeking. It's been a recurring theme for me, and I know probably for many of you here, to seek spiritual guidance and anchoring during periods of suffering or dukkha. So, you know, I'm grieving, and I end up purchasing this book of hers called The Wisdom of No Escape, which in all honesty, I ended up choosing in somewhat of a melodramatic way because of how poetic the title sounded. I didn't really know anything about Pema Chodron at the time or what the book would even be about. The book chapters were written in a written as discrete Dharma talks, each chapter basically focusing on a particular topic. And it really wove in these beautiful parables and metaphors, and all together, it really conveyed the practices and qualities of what it means to be a spiritual warrior. I was so taken by her writing that at some point I remembered feeling the impulse, and I actually went through with it to, or no, I didn't go through with it, but I felt the impulse to renounce everything and go to Gampo Abbey, which is the monastery that she lives at, to become a nun. But upon researching it, I had learned that they weren't accepting newcomers at the time. This was during COVID, so I figured I would have to renounce, you know, my life to become a nun some other time. But it was through really reading this book that I began developing a regular meditation practice, and probably more profoundly, when I began really leaning into discomfort, befriending myself, and really appreciating what it means to be in a state of groundlessness. So Pema's teachings, like all teachings, did not emerge in isolation. They are offerings that were influenced by her lineage, her teachers, and her personal life experiences. In terms of her life experience, to kind of give us all some context of who she is and where she comes from, before she became known to the world as Pema Chodron, she was born Deirdre Bloomfield Brown in 1936 in New York City. She was raised in a middle-class family and spent much of her childhood on the East Coast. She attended what is apparently a famous or prestigious boarding school called Miss Porter's School in Connecticut. And as a young adult, she ended up continuing her education at the University of California, Berkeley, where she earned a bachelor's in, and then she continued her education at Columbia University, where she ended up eventually becoming a school teacher afterwards. And it's during that time, after getting her master's and becoming a school teacher, that she ends up getting married and having children. So, on the surface, she was living this kind of standard American dream, getting married, having kids, having a profession. But underneath, as she accounts in a few of her books, she began to feel a sense of growing dissatisfaction. She experienced two divorces, the second of which she says left her emotionally devastated. And it was during this time of personal crisis in her late 30s that the seeds of her spiritual path were planted. In her own words, she describes this turning point not as a moment of enlightenment, but one of disillusionment and heartbreak. She felt as though her world had completely fallen apart, and it was that sense of groundlessness that eventually led her to Buddhism. She described this experience in a very poetic and human way in her book, When Things Fall Apart, and I wanted to read just the excerpt of it because I found it just very human. So she wrote, "I remember so vividly a day in early spring when my whole reality gave out on me. Although it was before I'd heard any Buddhist teachings, it was what some would call a genuine spiritual experience. It happened when my husband told me he was having an affair. We lived in northern New Mexico. I was standing in front of our adobe house drinking a cup of tea. I heard the car drive up and the door bang shut. Then he walked around the corner and, without warning, told me that he was having an affair and he wanted a divorce. I remember the sky and how huge it was. I remember the sound of the river and the stream rising up, or the steam rising up from my tea. There was no time, no thought, there was nothing, just the light and a profound, limitless stillness. Then I regrouped and picked up a stone and threw it at him." So, I for some reason, that excerpt just really stood out to me when I had read the book, and I think it really captures very well just a very raw moment in her life that really became the catalyst for her entering the spiritual path. So then in the early 1970s, Pema began studying Tibetan Buddhism, and she found a teacher who ended up becoming her most prominent and significant influence, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. He was a highly unorthodox and controversial figure, often known for his charisma and provocative teaching style. But he was also a very authentic lineage holder of Tibetan Buddhism. So Pema became a close student of Trungpa, and she immersed herself in practice. In 1974, she took a novice ordination in the Tibetan tradition from His Holiness the 16th Karmapa, which is one of the highest ranking figures in the Kagyu lineage. And then a few years later, in 1981, she took full Bhikshuni ordination in Hong Kong, becoming one of the first Western women to be fully ordained as a nun in the Vajrayana Buddhist tradition, which, upon doing my research, was actually quite an interesting fact to come across. She was given then the name Pema Chodron, which means lotus torch of the Dharma. It's very beautiful. The name reflects her role as a beacon of Buddhist wisdom, illuminating the path for others with clarity and compassion. After her ordination, her role within the Buddhist community really began to deepen at that point. In 1984, she was asked by Trungpa to become the director of Gampo Abbey, which is located in Nova Scotia. And it's actually the first Tibetan monastery for Western monastics in North America. Under her leadership, Gampo Abbey, she developed programs that were accessible to both committed monastics and lay people that were seeking spiritual depth. And even more importantly, she brought her deeply human and often humorous and very honest style of teaching to the monastery and eventually beyond. She became a very prominent figure in the Shambhala Buddhist community, which was an organization founded by Trungpa Rinpoche. And she worked very closely with senior teachers like Khonkrul Rinpoche, who became one of her main teachers after Trungpa's death. And though she had predominantly been teaching very quietly for many years at Gampo Abbey, she eventually publishes her first major book, which is The Wisdom of No Escape in 1991. And it wasn't until the release of When Things Fall Apart in 1996 that her work really gained widespread attention. This book in particular really struck a nerve with readers all over the world. Its central message that we can meet pain, fear, and uncertainty with compassion instead of avoidance really resonated with people across cultures and spiritual traditions and backgrounds. She soon after became a very sought-after speaker and retreat leader, offering teachings at venues ranging from monastic centers to prisons. And unlike many traditional Buddhist teachers, Pema speaks very plainly, very humanly, using vivid metaphors, parables, everyday language, and isn't afraid to share her personal struggles, which I imagine is what makes her such a relatable and admired figure in Buddhist practice because of her fearlessness when it comes to being vulnerable and really disseminating her teachings in an accessible and human way. And even though her popularity eventually soared with these books, she continued to live a very simple life, largely at Gampo Abbey, focusing on her study and her practice. And she's now, at this point, considered truly one of the most respected and beloved spiritual teachers in the West. So we see from Pema's history that her upbringing and her early adult years followed this archetypal American path. You go to school, you get married, you have kids. And like so many of us, her introduction into Buddhism and spirituality was born from a crisis, from her world essentially falling apart. And crisis and the experience of one's world falling apart can look so different for everybody. I mean, for Pema, it was being told that her husband wanted to get a divorce. For another person, it might be losing a job. For another person, it might be learning that they have some illness. But at the core of it is really this experience of groundlessness, like the rug being pulled out from under you, that kind of leaves you in a state of feeling disoriented and without a sense of direction. So her path really into spirituality was deeply human, and it's partly because of that that I think her teachings really resonate with so many of us, regardless of spiritual background. And we all truly encounter not just one, but often multiple crises throughout our lives. Crises that break us down, that shatter our worldviews, our conceptions of ourselves, or our relationships. And we can see just from Pema's life history that these crises while they leave us in a state of groundlessness, can paradoxically become the ephemeral ground from which we can deepen our intimacy with ourselves and our spiritual path. So I want to just pause here for a moment and open up question. I'm wondering first, how many of you can really resonate with this experience of crises or suffering leading to an interest or seeking of spirituality? Just out of curiosity.
Let me see the hands in here. One, two.
Okay, lots of hands. Julie and Steve, Peter.
There's six people in here at
Six
least.
people. Would anybody be comfortable or willing to maybe share their experience?
Well, I'll tell my story just to move things
Sure.
along. I don't like dead air. My marriage fell apart in the late 70s, and my business, making, selling jewelry, fell apart. And my father's health fell apart. And so all of those things kind of culminated in the late 70s and early 80s. And my wife left, my father died, and I had to change my lifestyle. And I made a decision one day that I did not want to live like this anymore. And that wasn't a suicidal thought. I just realized I needed to kind of reboot the system, recreate myself. And someone gave me a book by Joseph Goldstein, Experience of Insight. And I read that book, and 4 months later, I was on my first retreat, 1982. So, yeah, definitely very stressful transitional phase of my life is what precipitated this. I was interested in spirituality, but this is what really opened the door for me. Plus the wisdom of Buddhism. So that's my share. I will here in the room.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so my crisis was losing my father of a sudden stroke in 2009, and it led me to lose meaning to life. I realized no matter what I achieve or become, I'm still gonna die. And at that time, Einstein was one of my heroes, and I felt like if you can be smart enough, nobody can tell you what to do. But after realizing that even if I become him, I'm still gonna die, I just had nothing to live for. So they put me on Xanax and Zoloft. If anybody is not familiar with it, they're antidepressants. And that still wasn't cutting it. Until a very close friend of my father, who I was working for, told me about this meditation thing, which looked like Buddhist and totally rubbish to me at that time. He had stage 4 cancer, and he was definitely going to die. I was young, I was 30 at that time, and I was like, this guy is definitely going to die, and he's happy working every day, and he just has a beautiful approach to life. There got to be something. So I gave it a shot. I went to attend a meditation retreat. It was my birthday, coincided with my birthday. That was how bad I was. I just needed something. And my very first day was a huge reset or breakthrough. So when I came back, that was when I started looking into the literature to see what really changed, because I saw so many changes in me that medicine or my Christianity or everything I had read or learned or thought I knew hadn't done for me. So clinical depression was finding what it means to be really happy. That was my crisis.
Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing. And Peter, you as well. I think that in so far it's very clear.
Sorry, Eddie, your voice is faint again.
Oh, is it very low again?
It's better now.
Is it better? Okay, let me know if it's still an issue. I can troubleshoot it. But I was just saying thank you, Will, for sharing that, and Peter as well, because, I mean, it's so clear that, you know, these crises can look in so many different ways, but they all kind of, you know, lead to this result of really being curious about what else is out there that might give you a sense of guidance. Is there anyone else that might be interested in sharing?
I want to add another little story into this. The teacher for my first retreat was a survivor of World War II. Ruth Dennison, raised in, I think maybe Ukraine or someplace around there. And then World War II came along. And she had to find her way to France or England or something like that when the war was ending, to walk through all that. And then she went to California. She married a very wealthy man, went to California and started meditating and got her meditation training and started teaching. So I wanted to mention that because I think she's another really important female Dharma teacher. She's no longer alive. But it's one of the things that's impressed me is that most of my teachers have been women. It just happened that way. But it means that there's a really increasing number of women teaching the Dharma, and I think that's a really important part of Western Buddhism.
And it's beautiful,
and the women of the
Dharma series that
we're doing. Louder, please.
Oh, it speaks to the value of the Women of the Dharma series that we're doing.
No more hands raised in the room here.
All right, no worries. We can keep going. I appreciate everybody for sharing, for your vulnerability. So we covered her history, and I'd like to segue into her core teachings, which, I mean, she has so many, but I kind of distilled them into, I think it's five that really stood out to me. But, you know, when we think of spiritual teachers, we often might picture somebody that, you know, offers these very grand or abstract insights into enlightenment or transcendence. But Pema Chodron's teachings are very different. As mentioned before, they're very human, they're very real, and they speak directly to the pain, confusion, and tenderness of being human. So at the heart of Pema's teachings is the encouragement to stay present with discomfort. We might say that that is one of the first core teachings. In her book, When Things Fall Apart, she writes, "Rather than trying to make ourselves feel better, we learn to stay with uneasiness, with the tightening, with the itch of our cravings. We train in abiding with the restless energy of Shenpa and letting it be." Shenpa is a Tibetan term that she often uses, which refers to the moment that we get hooked emotionally. It's that flash of irritation, jealousy, fear, or the need to lash out. And she teaches us that it's those moments that are precisely the golden opportunities to sit with the Shenpa, with the discomfort, rather than turn away and give into the hook. So instead of reacting automatically, whether by blaming or escaping or numbing or pulling away. She really invites us to just pause. And in that pause, we can lean in. And over time, we can begin to interrupt the habitual cycles of suffering. And we develop what she calls the ability to hold our seat. This practice of staying, of not running away, becomes a radical act of bravery and fearlessness, which are also virtues that she frequently mentions throughout her books and teachings. It is by sitting with discomfort and by leaning into and facing our pain that often transformation can emerge. It is such a normal and human thing for us to turn away from pain or discomfort. On some level, we might say that we are wired for it if we think about, in psychological terms, the pleasure principle, which basically describes the habit that we ex essentially exhibit when we're infants of seeking pleasure and avoiding pain. So really on a fundamental level, it is natural for us to turn away from pain or discomfort and to reach for something that might give us a sense of pleasure or sense of safety. But while we may carry that propensity, we also carry this unique capacity to do the opposite. We can turn towards it. We can lean into it. And it's through this practice of leaning into discomfort that we not only deepen our capacity for fearlessness, but we embody the qualities of a spiritual warrior and gain access to the hidden gifts within the very thing we've been relentlessly avoiding. And this is captured beautifully by one of my favorite poets, Rumi, where he says, "Don't turn away. Keep your gaze on the bandaged place. That's where the light enters you." Or in other words, the wound is where the light enters you. And so this practice of really sitting with and leaning into discomfort can describe our first core teaching. Another central idea in her teachings is that freedom doesn't come from running away. It comes from fully experiencing what's here. This is the essence of her book, The Wisdom of No Escape, where she tells us that our flaws, our mistakes, our anxiety and confusion, all of these are not obstacles on the path. They are the path. She says, "The path is the goal, and what you are experiencing right now is the path." And this idea is very liberating and very humbling. It tells us that we don't need to wait for some perfect version of ourselves to show up before we can live a meaningful life. We start exactly where we are, with all of our messiness intact. This teaching is also similar to one of Ram Dass's teachings, where he describes your life as being your curriculum. And whether it's framed as the wisdom of no escape or your life being your curriculum, the teaching is the same. It's an invitation to view everything that shows up in life, whether internal or external, as grist for the mill, as Ram Dass puts it. There is nowhere one needs to go, no special person one needs to become in order to further themselves along the path of awakening. The teachings are always right under our nose. And apart from leaning into discomfort and really making use of everything and anything that shows up in life, there is also a single thread that truly runs through all of her teachings, and it is to learn to make friends with yourself. We live in a world that really pushes us to strive for perfection, that really pushes for consumption and constant stimulation, and oftentimes a zero tolerance policy for failure and mistakes. And Pema urges us to cultivate maitri, which is a Sanskrit word for loving kindness or unconditional friendliness. This is not about boosting our self-esteem or ignoring our flaws. It's really about turning towards ourselves, especially in our most vulnerable moments, with gentleness and care. She often shares a story about how she used to try to fix herself to become a better person. Her teacher, Trungpa, then challenged her to stop improving and start opening, to soften towards her pain rather than conquer it. She writes, "Compassion for others begins with kindness to ourselves," which I imagine is a common saying that I'm sure many of you have heard, where, you know, in order to truly love another person or have compassion for another person, it really starts with loving and being compassionate with ourselves. And this kindness isn't just for the moments where we're doing well. That's very easy to be kind to ourselves when things are going well and smooth. It's especially for those moments when we fall apart or lash out or simply lose faith, because it's precisely in those moments that we need it the most. And I remember, just as a personal account, when I first came across this notion of befriending myself in the Wisdom of No Escape, that I really became enamored with the softness and simplicity of the concept. It was like a light bulb moment when I read it. I was like, wow, you know, what an endearing thought to make friends with myself. And it made me realize that I've always had a relationship with myself. I've just been unconscious about it. And because I've been unconscious about it, I've been treating myself poorly. But being exposed to this teaching, it became clear that I have the ability to consciously develop a nurturing, gentle, and compassionate relationship with myself. And it's truly the relationship that you have with yourself that makes all the difference in terms of the subjective quality of how life ends up unfolding. We have so little control over the events that happen, both within and outside of us. But to cultivate a kind and friendly relationship with oneself may certainly bolster one's resiliency through difficult times. Her next core teaching, embracing groundlessness and uncertainty, is probably one of her most powerful teachings. The idea of groundlessness, that life is uncertain, ever-changing, and fundamentally without solid ground, is really thought-provoking. She explains that we all try to find something secure to hold on to, whether it's a belief, a role, a relationship, or a routine. But life keeps shifting and the ground we cling to keeps moving. Rather than fight this truth, she encourages us to relax into it, not in a passive way, but with awareness and openness. In her book, Comfortable with Uncertainty, she writes, "To be fully alive, fully human, and completely awake is to be continually thrown out of the nest." And this teaching can really feel intimidating at first, because it's kind of rattling to think of how boundless life really is, and often how it shakes up our entire sense of self. But it ends up becoming a source of deep freedom. When we stop resisting change, we begin to flow with life rather than against it. And the truth is that we're always in a state of groundlessness and uncertainty. We typically might feel the groundlessness in a more pronounced and visceral way in the midst of a crisis. But the reality is that life is always in flux, even in the mundane routines of our daily life. We might encounter these more mundane states of groundlessness when, for example, an expectation falls apart. Maybe you were expecting a smooth ride home from work, and then you're hit with traffic. Maybe you were planning to go to the park over the weekend, and then when the day comes, it's pouring relentlessly all day. So our expectations or our models of how we think or expect life is supposed to be are continuously being challenged and falling apart in both small and big ways. And it's in those moments that we're confronted with this truth. But there never was a ground beneath our feet to begin with. And while, like we said before, that can feel scary or intimidating, but to open up to this truth with an attitude of acceptance, relaxation, and even playfulness can transform our life experience from trying to direct an undirectable reality to allowing reality to guide you. And lastly, the importance of failure and falling apart. Perhaps one of her most comforting and transformative messages is that falling apart is not the end, it is often the beginning. And this famous book, When Things Fall Apart, is exactly about how our lowest moments, those times when life feels completely unmanageable, can be the moments that crack our hearts open. There's something so tender about that, even if the experience of it is generally devastating. There's a quote by Khalil Gibran that goes, "Your pain is the breaking of the shell that encloses your understanding. Even as the stone of the fruit must break, that its heart may stand in the sun, so must you know pain." And Pema, in one of her books, says, "Only to the extent that we expose ourselves over and over to annihilation can that which is indestructible be found in us." In other words, vulnerability, pain, and failure is not something to be avoided. It is the gateway to the spiritual path, to love, intimacy, and compassion, and oftentimes the catalyst for awakening. Thank you all. That wraps up my Dharma talk on Pema Chodron. Now we anything that has come up for any of you in response to all of this. Oh, Peter, you're muted. There you go.
Will and then Steve.
Okay.
Hey, Ali, so thank you so much for this. I think it was very wonderful. So the question I have is part personal and part the topic of, what we just discussed. So first off, sorry for losing your partner, boyfriend. Or maybe I should say I'm happy that happened. So the first question is, have you had any crisis similar to that? And how have you, dealt with it? How do I say this? I'm sure you've met it with compassion instead of running away like we all used to. Well, I still do it sometimes, but much less. So can you talk about if Pema Chodron had any other crises and she used her new technique to deal with it better? Or if you've had some similar experiences where you've brought compassion to a time of crisis and it's helped you?
That's a fantastic question. Yes, absolutely. There have been a number of crises that I've encountered apart from that breakup mentioned. Others a lot more intense and painful. And I can say from experience that, even in the crises that occurred in the aftermath, say, of that breakup that I had mentioned, that the path of healing and really developing that kind and compassionate relationship with self was not a linear process. And I think it's normal in the aftermath of a crisis, for there to really be this acute sense of groundlessness, as Pema has described. And I don't think it's abnormal in those states of groundlessness for it to be challenging to really figure out how to make sense of what's going on. But even in the confusion that might come up in the wake of something painful or dramatic, there can still be this background of compassion where one can say, okay, I don't really know why this happened or how to make sense of it or how to move forward, but I could at least have some compassion for myself in this moment for having this confusion and for feeling disoriented and for feeling groundless. And over time, things can become a little bit more clear in terms of what lesson can be extracted from a particular crisis, or how one might be able to derive a meaning that is fulfilling, or fulfilling isn't even maybe the right word, but that a meaning that is meaningful. I think that's the best way to put it. And I wonder, if I might kind of turn the question back towards you, Will, or even anybody else, if you've maybe gone through a period of crisis, and sometime later, I mean, it could be weeks later, months later, or years later, for you to look back on it and be like, oh, I feel like I really needed to go through that for some particular reason. Does that resonate with anybody? Yeah, okay, I'm hearing some mhms.
No.
No, I appreciate the authenticity, Marty.
Yeah.
Would you like to share?
I have a question for you.
Sure.
I hear a lot of, okay, so what I'm going through is I lost my husband, and death is part of life, but for some reason I'm just not pulling myself together the way I feel like I should. I have that, like there's no ground, there's no, it's just a lot of difficult, hard feelings that I'm going through. And they say open, like you said, she said just open to it. And I'm not really sure what that means when it, like if you sit with it or you face it or I don't know what that means to open to the pain or to open to the discomfort or to open. I don't know how to open to those things. Can you expound on that?
Absolutely. And Marty, I really appreciate your vulnerability in sharing that. And I think that, a different word that I might use instead of open maybe might be to allow.
Allow it to be. No,
Allow.
because I hear other people say that too a lot. Like when I read or listen to the, books on tape and stuff, they're saying open to it. I'm like, okay, how do you do that?
Yeah, I hear you, and I think I could relate to the confusion with that, because it's like, well, what am I opening? I mean, it's there.
Like I would like for it to stop hurting.
Right, and I think that's a deeply human sentiment.
And if I could make it go away, I would, but I can't. That's the hard part, is that, when you're grieving, it just kind of just it's there and it's always there, and you wake up in the morning, you say, well, I'm gonna have a good day, but then, the feeling is there. So I don't know.
Yeah.
Can I respond to that, Allie?
Yes, of course.
What I do is I work with physical discomfort. There's a point of resistance where my mind wants to reject the pain by changing position or whatever. And so I intentionally drop the resistance, particularly when I'm exhaling. Just let go into it. And that gives me confidence that I can also let go into grief. There have been times when I've been on retreat when old painful memories came up. And I just opened to the totality of what was going on in my body and in my mind, my heart, about this sense of loss, knowing that I could ride it out because I could ride out the pain in my knees, so for example, which I'm experiencing right now as I speak. So that's how I find my way to let go or open or accept.
All right. Thank you. Okay.
Steve, you had something?
We were done with Will's two-parter.
Yes.
Oh, well,
Okay.
did, yeah, okay.
Great. Thank you for the presentation, Allie. You were mentioning leaning into discomfort, which that's a theme I enjoy, and we were just talking about it to some extent. And I think Peter's given a quote, or maybe it's his quote, of softening into the edges. I might be paraphrasing a little bit of something. I like keeping that in my little list of wordy things. Anyway, you began tying that into self-compassion. I was going to say self-resentment. That was nice because I felt that's where that was going, or that's what came up for me, and then you sort of tied it into self-compassion, which I appreciate. And I wanted to share something that's hopefully not too tangential, but it's brief. A few years back, I started sort of investigating any sort of resentment that I have because I kind of feel like a symptom of non-self-compassion is outward resentment, pointing the finger at people a lot, or just resentment that's internal that you feel. In the process of investigating that with my therapist, she at some point said told me that I needed to have more self-compassion, that I was too hard on myself. And I thought, I'm just trying to be careful here that I don't slip back into being the sort of smart ass that I was when I was younger, thinking that kind of being full of myself anyway. And she was like, that I don't know if that quite adds up. So I sent my friend a message and I said, hey, what do you think? A buddy of mine that I've known for 30 years. I'm like, what do you think? Back in high school, do you think I was kind of full of myself back then? And he responded in a long email that included, you know what? I thought you were too hard on yourself 30 years ago. And I always thought you needed some more self-compassion. I cried reading the Zima. I thanked him for it later. But that was interesting. But a lot of this, so much of this ties into self-compassion. And that's just something I could talk about or study, endlessly, as well as resentment and how it relates. Anyway, thanks for the presentation.
Yeah. Thank you, Steve. Yeah. I self-compassion. Oh, does someone say something? Is that?
Yeah, Allie, I don't know if you can hear me. I don't know if there's a queue ahead of me, Sharon. And I couldn't agree more with what Steve just said and what you said, that you brought up self-compassion and the ability to have a real connection to our heart. I mean, literally, when I practice metta, or the mantra of, you know, may I be safe, may I be whatever, and to really feel it in a way that is profound. And I couldn't agree more with how we don't often experience things, or we think of ourselves in a way that maybe others don't see us, or maybe they do. And I think it's interesting that we can find out just by asking people who have sincerely known us and are willing to share their thoughts over, let's say, at a time later on. But thank you again for saying something about the self-compassion. Just as a quick thing, I was listening to Thich Nhat Hanh earlier today talking about loneliness. It was a talk that he gave back in 2012, and how, you know, this is like 20 several years later, more than a decade later, he was talking about how loneliness is such a common experience in our culture. And I think that's tied in also to our relationships, that we often are guarded maybe, and we have we don't have a profound ability to be whole within ourselves, just by being. And I meditated on that earlier in the day. I just wanted to share it on YouTube if anybody's interested in listening. And I read the transcript as well, because the transcript really was helpful in reviewing how attached we are to experiences that are through our devices, through email, through texting, through, you know, we relate in a way that is, I guess we could say, it's superficial.
Yeah. Thank you, Sharon. Marty, did you want to say something?
No, I was, no.
Oh, okay.
Just listening.
Sure.
I appreciate the talk too. I wanted to say that.
No, I'm so glad that you could join us and be a part of our group today. And, you know, yourself and I think so many others that have shared so far, I think just show, like serve as examples of how suffering and crisis can come up in all of these different forms and in all these different like degrees and how painful it can be. And there's a sense of compassion for oneself that can arise just from the acknowledgement of how human of an experience it is to grieve, or to experience resentment, or to feel lonely. I mean, these are just all a part of the human condition. And from that, one can just have a little bit of compassion and gentleness with oneself.
I need to read some of her books.
Oh yeah, she's great. I have a list of them. I have them right next to me. But yeah, When Things Fall Apart, I'd say is her.
Let's start there.
Yeah.
That's probably appropriate for me.
Ashley has something for us.
I wanted to ask Ali, in her opinion, so you mentioned that one of Pema's core teachings was, maybe it wasn't a core teaching, but you mentioned befriending oneself. What were the practical, or what was the path that you followed in order to befriend yourself, and how did you know when you got there?
What a beautiful question. So, you know, it's interesting. So I'm a psychotherapist, for those of you who might not be aware, but a common exercise in self-compassion or in the context of your question of making friends with yourself that I often offer patients are the how would you treat a friend exercise. So it's basically, you know, what would you tell a friend, or how might you treat a friend who may be going through whatever it is that you're going through at the moment? And often people are like, oh, you know, I would tell them that they are amazing and I adore them and, you know, everything's going to be okay. I mean, that's, you know, those are kind of cliche platitudes, but the essence is that it can often come up so much more naturally, this sense of friendliness and compassion when in the context of a friend. But I think the same, like the essence of it is that, you know, in the same way that you might nurture a friendly relationship with a friend, we just turn that towards ourselves. So in my experience, it was like, all right, you know, it's Saturday. What do we want to do? You know, do we want to go to the park? Do we want to get some coffee? Like really kind of asking myself and treating myself as if I were a distinct person or friend. How do I want to spend my time today? Or, you know, if I am going through some particular trouble, what might I tell a friend? I might offer them some comfort. So I might offer myself some comfort. I might make myself some tea. Maybe ask myself, what do I need right now in this moment? And I might myself respond like, you know, I feel like I really just need to take a bath and put on my favorite show and just unwind for tonight. And then I'm like, all right, girl, let's do it. So when thinking about what it practically looks like to make friends with yourself, I think an easy path to conceptualizing that is really just thinking within the context of how might you treat your really good or best friend, and then making an honest effort to treat yourself as if you are your own best friend. I hope that offers some practical insight, but if not, let me know and I can maybe elaborate further.
Thank you.
John has something?
Yeah, I wanted to say thank you, Ari. I think that it is a great ability to learn at a young age that you can hurt yourself with your thoughts. Now, in a relationship, if you're depending on this other person to make you happy, you don't have a relationship because you don't have a relationship with yourself. That's what you do for yourself. And one of the great reasons that I sit is because I get moments of stillness. I get moments of longer spans of, I call it no think, call it what you want. And that allows me to feel myself and not be so judgmental. I love that word, self-compassionate, you know, because that is truly what it is. It's just, don't hurt yourself with your words. Don't hurt yourself with your thoughts, because each word is from a thought. So if you can quiet that mind down, you can feel that heartbeat. You can at least, I mean, life is not easy, but it's nice to quiet it down and have a warmth that you can go to and touch and count on, but don't get yourself, you know, you get 60,000 thoughts a day. Don't get yourself too beat up. And it's easy to do. And it's nice to hear somebody, a different way of putting it. So I like that self-compassion, because that's what it is. And that's what it boils down to. That's why I sit. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, Will has has a question.
So how do we befriend ourselves if our whole goal is to free ourselves from inherent resistance?
From inherent what?
Resistance, like no self.
Ooh. That's a great question.
In 25 words or less.
Oh, goodness, Peter. So, I mean, it's paradoxical, right? And it's kind of akin to the question of like, well, if desire is the root of suffering, then is it wrong to desire awakening? It's one of those paradoxical questions.
The Buddha said that's the only legitimate desire.
So he made an exception for that one. But I think that it's absolutely possible to develop a friendly and gentle relationship with self without necessarily reinforcing the concept of a permanent enduring and autonomous self, which is ultimately what we're trying to uproot. But to maybe think of making friends with yourself as more of a process, right? Because this concept of self, if we can even call it that, is truly a process that we just kind of ascribe a sense of permanency to. But in, say, a moment of difficulty, to say, just put a gentle hand on your chest and say, may I be happy, may I be healthy, may I be safe, just offer yourself some loving kindness, I think is a symbol and is enough to reinforce this gentle, compassionate relationship with oneself without reinforcing the concept of self. But Peter, I invite you to share your insight if maybe you have a different take.
Oh, yeah, you're on the right track. All I would say is that one of the most fundamental ways I befriend myself is going back to the breath, to kind of mirror off of what John said. And I'm not being facetious when I say that. I mean, it's a routine for me. It's very reassuring. But the more I am aware of it informally, the more workable it is for me when I'm actually formally meditating. And the more I do it with some degree of consistency when I'm formally meditating, the easier it is for me to make good use of it during the day. So that to me, that's the foundation for loving kindness, is letting go back to the simplicity of being with the breath. We are at the
Can
end
I
of our
share
time
something
tonight.
at this?
So,
Okay.
yeah, we've run over quite a bit. But Sharon, what did you want to say there?
I just when I was listening to you talking and Allie about from a professional point of view, I remembered Irina Weissman had a wonderful, beautiful guided meditation that talked about how we should love ourselves as though we were our own parents. And then I started thinking about the counselor years ago who operated on the inner child. He would have like people in I guess they would attend his talks, and they were visioning themselves as children. And I was going to say to connect back to the vulnerable inner child is also something that I hadn't thought about before tonight's discussion for a long time. But anyway, I know we're at the end, so thank you for allowing me to say that.
Thank you, Allie, for your research and your practice and your sharing with us. I'm very grateful.
Thank you all for being present and attending and your wonderful questions. It really is an honor and a privilege to be able to give this talk.
So, at the end of our meeting, we have a moment of sitting together. Thank you for your practice. Wish you well. I hope we're all reasonably safe and happy until next time we have a chance to chat.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks, Peter.